You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 30th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo is brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from here in Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
You know, if you ask the average Palestinian on the street, of course they're happy about it, but they have got other concerns at the moment, and this it's very much, you know, an Israeli perspective on something that they see as unacceptable, and the Palestinians see it, of course, as their right.
Palestinian prisoners, Syrian peace talks and violence in Tunisia. Kathleen Burke and Rachel Shabby are here to pore over the day's top news stories. Then, Philip Hook, author of Breakfast at Sotheby's and A to Z of the art world, will join us live at the Monocle Cafe. We'll also visit the last country producing one of the 20th century's most recognisable vehicles.
Halting of the Cumbis production in Brazil is just another sign of Brazil moving forward. Even though there are fears from middle-class entrepreneurs that their businesses will be hurt, there's no doubt that they will adapt to keep their businesses alive.
All that to come, plus some great music too, and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24 coming up for you on Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to get through then in the next hour here on the show, but first, let's hear from David Spencer, who has the latest news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Chinese authorities say that five suspected Islamist militants are in custody in connection with what they are now calling a terror attack in Beijing. They were held after a vehicle burst into flames in Tiananmen Square on Monday, killing two tourists. Police say the SUV involved was driven by Usman Hassan, while his wife and mother were also with him in the car. They all died in the incident. Police say they found devices filled with petrol, knives and extremist material in the car. Authorities have also moved to tighten security in the western region of Xinjiang, where the suspects are from. Congolese troops have entered the eastern border town of Bunagana after M23 rebels abandoned the last major town they were holding. The town on the Ugandan border was first seized last year by the rebels, and its loss is the latest significant success in an offensive by UN-backed forces. The likes of the United States have called for a return to talks, however, warning of further violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo if no diplomatic solution is found. There have been clashes between police and student protesters in Cairo following the arrest of another leading Muslim Brotherhood figure. Assam al-Aryan was taken into custody early on Wednesday and is one of many members of the group that have been detained since the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi. Morsi and a number of the other detainees are due to go on trial next week in relation to charges of inciting violence. The UN inquiry into human rights violations in North Korea says there is a disturbing pattern of abuse. The UN set up the inquiry in March, following pressure by Japan, South Korea and Western powers in a bid to begin building a case for a possible criminal prosecution. The findings have been rejected, though, by Pyongyang. Michael Kirby, the chair of the commission, says, though, some of the evidence is overwhelming.
There have been a number of the testimonies which have moved me to tears, and I'm not ashamed to say that. You would have to be a stony-hearted person not to be moved by the stories that the Commission of Inquiry has received.
The French government has denied paying a ransom for the release of four French hostages held in the Sahara for 3 years. There have been emotional scenes at a military airport near Paris as they were reunited with their families. They were originally kidnapped in northern Niger in 2010. A special celebration has been held in a Norwegian town that is suddenly seeing the light. Rjukan is in almost complete darkness between September and March, but now three mirrors have been installed on a mountain above the town to reflect sunlight into the market square. The reflected light will be between 80 and 100% as bright as direct sunlight. The mirrors have two axes on which they move and a computer program that will follow the sun's path during the entire year. Øystein Aragon is the Sun Mirror project manager and says people are warming to the idea.
They say, hooray, this is a nice idea. When we now have the sun down to the town square, people coming here, they're taking pictures, they are laughing and have a good time.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David Spencer. Bringing us there, quite literally, a little bit of sunshine in our news bulletin.
Bringing sunshine into the news. What a marvellous idea that is.
Very nice. You're always a ray of warm sunshine, David. David will be back later this hour with some news headlines at the halfway mark. Right now, though, you're tuned into Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. The time's 18.06 here in London, 14.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the big stories of the day here in studio are Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and alongside her and me, Rachel Shabby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Welcome both. Welcome back to the programme. Always good to have you with us here at Midori House. We're going to start today in Syria. Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN envoy, spoke with embattled President Bashar al-Assad this morning. The meeting came on the third day of Brahimi's first visit to Damascus in almost a year. He's been on a regional tour trying to drum up support for peace talks in Geneva, planned for late next month. Meanwhile, Assad has been quoted on state television as saying, rather unhelpfully, that the success of any political solution is tied to stopping support for terrorist groups and pressuring their patron states. Where to begin with this? I guess a simple question. These peace talks are dead in the water before we've even got started, Kathleen. Is that too negative a spin to put on this?
I think it's probably dead on. I mean, the point is man lives by hope, right? And the idea is if at least there's talks about talks, it might sort things out a little bit on the margins. But if one side says nothing can happen unless Assad goes, and the other side says we're not talking to terrorists, there's not a lot left.
A bleak situation. Rach, would you sort of go along with that?
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is, you know, as you say, Brahimi has been on a regional tour trying to drum up support and some sort of consensus over these negotiations, which even by his own admission are not definitely happening at the end of November. And the trouble is, as you say, that we have one side, the opposition, who doesn't want to negotiate unless there's a precondition that Assad is removed. And on the other hand, Bashar al-Assad isn't entirely incorrect when he says that we need to tackle the issue of terrorists being funded by, what did he say?
Enemy patron states.
Patron states. Okay, well, that's quite mild. but, you know, of course, that's what has become of what started off as an uprising and has now become a civil war that is also a proxy war. And so we have patron states like Saudi and other Gulf states who are supporting now very violent militants, al-Qaeda affiliated militants. So they equally have to be persuaded to stop doing that. So, you know, Assad does actually have a point there, and that's a problem. And the other thing is that Brahimi has almost lost his voice trying to urge that Iran be a part of these negotiations. Iran being one of the key supporters of the Syrian regime, it would make no sense for them not to be involved. And of course, the US and other Western states have consistently and completely unhelpfully refused that.
I mean, the thing is, you've got a cross purposes here. On the one hand, you've got a great Muslim civil war between Shia and Sunni. And along with that, you've got essentially a geopolitical war. I mean, I agree with what Rachel said, and take it even a little bit further, is that you've got a war between Iran and Saudi Arabia for being the prime power in the region. So you've got Iran supporting Syria, of course, and you've got the Saudis supporting the opposition, so that you are having countries who are both religious and military using, that's very good, a proxy war. And then behind them, as you say, you've got the EU on one side and you've got the Americans on the Saudi side, except the Americans are now talking to the Iranians. So the Saudis are getting cross at the Americans. And then, of course, there's the rest of North Africa. So what you have right there is an amazing political, religious maelstrom. And it's very difficult to see how one is going to work one's way out of it.
If we're confronted with them with this maelstrom, which it certainly seems to be, should we be in any way surprised then that Assad appears to have been emboldened by his recent experiences? Certainly the rhetoric has been very aggressive. This is quite hostile, talking about the patron states. Do you think that's a step too far from him, though? Or should we be unsurprised that he does feel emboldened by his experiences? I mean, after all, why should he feel any other way?
Well, I don't know if it's emboldened so much as just stating the obvious. And, you know, I don't know if he's emboldened by the fact that the US is warming towards Iran in another field of activity, much to the annoyance of both Saudi and Israel, who are allied in their revulsion for this, if nothing else. But, you know, we have known for some time that the only way out of this is a negotiated political solution. There is no other way. The opposition is still convinced of the fact that it can undermine Assad by continuing to fight. That is manifestly not true. And yet the West continues to encourage and support the opposition in its assumption of this fact. Now, that to me is actually quite reprehensible behavior, as much as it is reprehensible of Russia and Iran to continue to fund Assad's bloodbath on his own people.
Well, strong words there, Kathleen. Do you go along with that?
Well, I think we're forgetting that also what's developing is an incredible civil war within the opposition. I think actually it could go on for quite a long time without peace talks, because as long as it's contained within Syria, it's still there are a number of countries who would benefit to have that continuing.
But it's not contained within Syria.
Well, yes. Well, in a sense, it's obviously it's dribbling a little bit down into Jordan and Turkey.
Spilled over into Iraq massively.
Indeed. But the jihadis are going into Syria right now. And if they're in Syria, they're not bothering in Saudi Arabia, or they're not bothering so much in other countries. And also, of course, Russia's self-respect is tied up with this now, which brings in another consideration. So I am second to no one in hoping I like diplomacy. I'm hoping that talks will work. It is just difficult for me to see who benefits from talks within Syria right now.
But that's like saying the cynical truth about all this is that, you know, the only people who would benefit, obviously, Syrians and other people in the region, Iraq, who obviously the same militants fighting in Syria are now crossing over into Iraq, which is why we're seeing these awful daily deaths in Iraq, not to mention the spillover of refugees into nations that simply cannot cope with that, like Jordan, Turkey and Lebanon. But as long as it's just those people that are affected and not the rest of us, we can just let Syrians carry on killing each other. That's effectively what you're saying.
What I'm saying is that if one looks at it really, I mean, I'm hardly saying this is what I would like. I'm trying to look at this clear-eyed in a way, no matter what, who cares what I like. I'm just trying to say that if one looks at it, who benefits from it stopping? Who benefits from it continuing? Who doesn't want it to stop because they're not going to stop until they get what they want? Mm. Well, peace talks solves no problems right now because there's no one who has the strength to enforce what might come out of peace talks.
What about the UN?
Oh, yeah. Which peacekeeping force
They did it in Bosnia. They can do it if there are enough nations behind it.
Well, they did it in Bosnia because they had a lot of NATO troops there backing them up.
So they have support. They can do it with the will. And you're right. There is no will because not enough of the superpowers benefit from a solution, and that's the ugly truth.
That may be the ugly truth. We're going to move on from this one now, but an ugly truth to confront, perhaps. Fascinating, though, no doubt about it. Let's move on to talk a little bit about Israel, Rachel, we mentioned a moment or two ago, in a slightly different context, of course, back to this sort of ongoing can we optimistically still call it a peace process? Hopefully, yes. 26 Palestinian prisoners released from jail on Tuesday evening, part of this process to attempt to resume these talks between the two sides. Amongst those released was Issa Abed Rabo, the longest serving Palestinian prisoner incarcerated in Israel. 28 years ago, of course, he was jailed. This is part, we should remember, of the four planned prisoner releases the Palestinian Authority has described as a crucial step in achieving this full amnesty and eventual statehood on the West Bank. Rich, if I can start with you on this, I suppose a cynic might say, does this still matter?
A cynic might say that. Certainly, you know, correspondents have been reporting the groundhog day that is Palestinian-Israeli peace negotiations might say that too. This is, as you say, phase two of a phased agreement. This is one of the things that got Palestinians and Israelis back to the negotiation table. This was one of the things brokered by the US. The Israelis will make it a big deal because they always do, you know, painful concessions, et cetera, et cetera. Palestinians will make it a huge victory because they always do. Every side is playing its part in this equation. And of course, Israel has countered the release of a mere 26 political prisoners with the announcement of 1,500 new housing units in the occupied West Bank. So that there's a kind of, you know, counterplay there. And we're hearing Israeli newspapers report that actually that was what part of Netanyahu's right-wing coalition, that was what they promised as a get-out for these prisoners. They said, yeah, we'll let them go. But on the other hand, look, we're going to build more settlements. So actually we're winning. And that's the main thing.
Do you think, Catherine, do you go along with that? I mean, it's one of these classic dynamics, isn't it? It's always played out as a sort of a success by both sides, or there's outrage, measured outrage, which is nicely stage managed, perhaps as a PR exercise. More of the same in this case? Do you think that's exactly what we should have been expecting?
I think Rachel summed it up extremely well. I can't agree more. I just, again, it's one of those considerations almost like Ireland, where you have to wait till generation dies and goes away till anything can actually happen. It's hard to see how one can get out of the roadblock right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the US reaction. I mean, we've sort of discussed what the response will be in Ramallah in Israel, of course. What about the US, Kathleen? What do you think? Is it with a sort of measured optimism? Do they understand share a sort of cynical view? What do you think the US response will be? John Kerry, to this latest prisoner release, this latest stage?
I mean, if they have time to think about it right now?
Still high on the list.
Survival might be nice, yeah. I suppose. I don't think it would have happened without their acquiescence. You know, so one can only assume that this is what one can accomplish.
I mean, the Americans are really driving this negotiation. Everybody else has just gone, give up. And the Americans really want a success story somewhere in the Middle East, you know. But the problem is that, for the Palestinians, it's almost like, you know, the leadership is so far behind the Palestinian people, who are so over negotiations. It's so clear that negotiations are really just a way for Israel to reinforce and expand on its existing settlements and infrastructure. That has been blatantly clear by the 20 plus years of the Oslo peace process. And Palestinians are shifting much more into, you know what, we actually have options. We are now observer status members of the UN. We've joined UNESCO. We could take Israel to court. That would be a much better option. And I think that idea is gaining traction amongst the Palestinian people. And this, of course, is what the US is so afraid of, which is why it's pushing these kind of dead in the water negotiations so hard.
Just very briefly on this, Catherine, as a final thought then, you mentioned that generational shift, comparisons with Northern Ireland, of course. Is that what it's going to take? Or do you think that there will be some within the sort of Palestinians camp who say, actually, yeah, there are these incremental gains that can be made. Maybe the slow burn approach, we end up in court, would suit us better. Is it going to take a generation, or is there some chance, some prospect perhaps, that something could happen sooner than that?
One is hard pushed to think of it. I mean, it's there's,
ouch.
Well,
yeah,
niggling war, a lot of frustration, the occasional switching of 26 prisoners for 1,500 houses. But it's hard to see how anything, there's too much intransigence on both sides. Mm. No one can give up. because either you lose something, even if it's only face, and you can't lose face if you're in politics, I shouldn't have thought.
Absolutely. Let's move on. Our next area of discussion, we're going to head to Tunisia. We had a suicide bomber today blowing himself up at the tourist resort of Sousse. The first such assault in more than 10 years. The country is... So frequently we observe in a fight against Islamist militants who have taken advantage of instability in neighbouring Libya. Let's actually cross live now to Tunisia. Monocle's contributor Navina Kotor is at the scene of this bombing in Sousse. Navina, tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in Sousse at the moment.
Good evening, Tom. In Sousse at the moment, the security situation seems to have relaxed a bit. The beach where the bombing happened this morning is freely accessible, and I went there earlier to talk to people who were basically walking around, having a look at the site and discussing between themselves. One of the men I met there was a Norwegian businessman. He works in the tourism industry, and he gave me his reaction to the bombing.
Well, I live here. We work with tourism. So it's a sad day because it's more sad for the Tunisians. We only affected by business, but the Tunisians are, this is a new day with something we haven't seen before. So that's sad. To me, this is not Tunisia. This is another world. This is Iraq, Afghanistan. But I think the idea came from abroad and entered some people and who want to do damage, but the majority they like tourism, they like and benefit from it and eat from it, so it will hurt the whole country if this continue. But I hope it's one event and won't continue. But no one innocent died, only the one who wanted to die, he got what he wanted.
Yeah, and as you said, nothing more serious than that happened here today. But people were quite, well, people were in a state of shock, I have to say. And there were a lot of discussions on the beach between people trying to reassure each other. And among them was this Tunisian woman who was speaking to one of the eyewitnesses there who had seen, who was basically there when the man blew himself up. He himself was covered in blood, he said, and his hearing was impaired for a couple of hours. And this Tunisian woman who was talking to him and apologizing was adamant that this was not symptomatic for Tunisia.
The old Tunisian woman and men and child, we are very, very sorry for tourism and tourists in Tunisia. Tunisia is not this terrorist. We are not there. And we are here to protect tourists first and Tunisia.
Navina, I wonder then, what's the mood like in Sousse more broadly? Is there a general sense of concern that this could be something we'll see more of? The hotel staff, even, for example, are they fairly confident this is something that can be got to grips with, or is there a general mood of concern?
I think at the moment the hotel staff are trying to deal with the situation, trying to reassure tourists who are here and in shock, basically. Most of the people are in the lobby now and talking to each other and trying to reassure each other, talking to the tour operators, trying to find out whether they should leave the country or not. I have to say, I think there's a lot of confusion here. I spoke to some British tourists earlier who hadn't heard until I told them that there was a suicide attack outside the hotel. So there's a lot of confusion. And I was speaking to one of the managers here at the hotel about what they are trying to do to deal with the situation.
I'm a little bit, let's say, not in shock, but in the fire of action, let's say. Then we didn't have the time to think and to analyze what's happening. Now I'm in the situation of handling the situation as maximum as we can and as thinking especially of the guests and everything to make it more comfortable for them and more convenient for them. And after I will have time to analyze what's happening, what did it really happen and what can be my emotion.
And what are you doing to help your guests?
Actually, what we have done is like, first of all, when the situation did happen, we secured all our guests inside of the hotel in the swimming pool. We double checked that no one was injured, thanks God. We checked that all our employees also were fine. And afterwards, we had to manage, let's say, to double the security. Then we have called some of the employees who were out of duty, and we asked them all to come back. And there was a reinforcement for all the kind of department, reception, room division, everyone was all hands on deck, let's say.
Navina, that's some of the voices then in Sousse. Just very briefly, what's your take on this? What do you think we'll see in the next few days and weeks? Would we be wrong to expect more attacks of this character?
I'm not sure about more attacks. I mean, we have seen some violence, and policemen and National Guard, members of the National Guard were killed last week. We might see some violence. I don't really want to predict that. I think, though, this is very likely to have an effect on what is happening in Tunis at the moment. They're trying to finalize the constitution and appoint a new government. And I wouldn't be surprised if this new government was appointed quicker to make it easier for parliamentarians to focus on the constitution. I think people in this country do not want to see more of this, and they want their politicians to deal with it. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were expressions of anger and protests in the coming days. But it's hard to say. I mean, nobody has claimed responsibility for this attack so far.
Thank you so much. That's Navina Couture, Monocle's contributor in Sousse, the scene of today's bombing. Still with me in the studio are Rachel Shabby and Kathleen Burke. Rachel and Kathleen, I wonder, is there a sort of a rather sorry story unfolding here? Tunisia, we think about the whole sort of journey through the Arab Spring, maybe not too many contenders to be the sort of success story, if you like, out of it. Tunisia perhaps was going to be one. Should we fear now that that's all in jeopardy? What do you think, Rachel?
Yeah, that's the thing. Tunisia was always kind of cast as the poster child of the Arab uprisings because it had a sort of the most sort of stable and seemingly sensible way out. And I think the tourism angle is key. When I was there a few months ago, this was after the assassination of Shoukry Belaid, the political opposition figure, people would desperate for me to sort of relay back that, you know, Tunisia was safe, because that was one of the things that it just sort of hemorrhaged the tourists that it so desperately needs to get its economy back on track. But yeah, as you say, this is, you know, partly spillover from what's happening in Egypt, partly because there is a supply of both militants and weapons coming over from Libya. Tunisia is kind of caught in between, and its coalition of Islamists and non-Islamists is now frayed and has been disabled, sensibly, I think. You know, the Islamist Ennahda party has actually responded to the people's will and dissolved that. But yeah, there is now an urgency to get the political process back on track, to get a constitution that's approved, and to get a new national unity government in place as soon as possible, so that it can tackle this kind of political violence that will inevitably try and destabilize it.
Intriguing stuff. You're listening to Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. I'm here with Rachel Shabby, also Kathleen Burke. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in just a moment to discuss why a delegation of German intelligence officials has just landed at the White House of all places. They're not there to spy, but maybe they might be scolding. Stay tuned.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, I'm delighted to say. Still with me in the studio is Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL, and the journalist and author Rachel Shabby. Let's move on now to talk about the White House. A delegation of German officials has arrived today for talks about the ongoing surveillance scandal. Chancellor Angela Merkel's top foreign policy man, Christoph Heusgen, and her intelligence coordinator, Günther Heiss, are to meet with James Clapper, Obama's Director of National Intelligence, and his National Security Advisor, Susan Rice. The idea, apparently, to rebuild trust intriguing idea. I wonder, is this all just for a show for, you know, political purposes, to try and play out for domestic audiences? Kathleen, what do you think? Should we sort of greet this with a healthy dose of scepticism?
Well, everything is useful being greeted with a healthy dose of scepticism. It's a curious thing. I mean, the Germans, as far as one can tell, are partly outraged. I mean, for all sorts of reasons, historical reasons, we know, and partly there is a certain hyperbole. I mean, the Americans and the Germans have been cooperating very closely, not as closely as the Five Eyes, you know, but the Anglo-Saxon powers, as it were, but certainly very closely. I think what drove it is the idea that even the Chancellor would have been listened to. I think that crossed a line. That really did cross a line. But in terms of not knowing the Americans were doing this, I just don't believe that for a moment. Because there is a close intelligence cooperation between Germany and France and the United States and Great Britain, which is the elephant here. Mm. They know they're doing it almost as much as they do it for each other. You see, if the Americans can't do it in America, the British can do it for them. If the French can't do it on their own, the British can do it for them. There's an awful lot of interchange like that. And so I do think, though, the bottom line is that there is a bottom line, and the Americans have decided if it can be done, they'll do it, and it may come in handy.
Absolutely. I just wanted very briefly on this then. Do you think there will be serious repercussions? You talk about crossing that line, but then at the same time, there is a sort of tacit understanding, one imagines, that all of these things are going on. Will there be serious repercussions in the sort of medium term between the EU broadly, to these big brokers, and the US, or do you think that it's a bit of a storm in a teacup and they will all actually end up getting on with things?
Well, it's a storm in a very large teacup in that sense. No, it's more than that, especially amongst those who are not involved in the intelligence equation, you know, and I think the trade talks for a little bit between the EU and the US are being put on hold.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for the day. That's Kathleen Burke. Alongside us was Rachel Shabby. Thank you both very much for joining us here today at Midori House for today's Aperitivo.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street very shortly to talk through the A to Z of art with Philip Hook of Sotheby's. And we'll also preview all the excitement that's coming up later today on the Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. Before we get our teeth sunk into all that, let's catch up with the latest world news headlines. Here with them is David Spencer.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. Chinese police say five suspects have been arrested as they confirmed that Monday's car crash in Tiananmen Square was an orchestrated terror attack. All three people in a Jeep were killed when it crashed into a crowd of pedestrians and caught fire just outside of the Forbidden City. Two tourists were also killed. There has been a suicide bomb attack in the Tunisian tourist resort of Sousse. No one was hurt in the blast apart from the attacker. Police in Tunisia foiled another attack when they arrested a would-be suicide bomber in the seaside town of Monastir and detained five other people in Sousse thought to be plotting attacks. Four Frenchmen held hostage in the Sahara Desert by al-Qaeda-linked gunmen for 3 years have returned home. They were kidnapped in 2010 while working in northern Niger. The French government has denied that a €20 million ransom was paid. A German delegation is in Washington for talks on claims that the National Security Agency monitored Chancellor Angela Merkel's private mobile phone. On Tuesday, the head of the NSA insisted it's been acting within legal boundaries amid concern over surveillance of allies. President Barack Obama's top health official has apologised for the botched rollout of the government's healthcare website. Kathleen Sebelius acknowledged it was a debacle, but also blamed insurers for cancelling coverage for hundreds of thousands of people. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. David will be back, of course, at the top of the next hour with a full bulletin of news. Up next, though, on Aperitivo, we're going to head to the Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street for a coffee and a bit of conversation. Today's show, we'll be meeting Philip Hook. Philip's a director and senior painting specialist at Sotheby's, who's worked in the art world for 35 years and found the time to write 5 novels and 2 works of art history. He's now written Breakfast at Sotheby's, an A to Z of the art world, which has been called a revealing exploration of exactly how art acquires its value. Philip is joined now at the cafe by Monocle's senior editor and a work of art in herself. It's Sophie Grove. Sophie, over to you.
Tom, thank you very much for the compliment. I am here, very cosy in the cafe with Philip. Philip, the book is an A to Z of the art world, but it's also a lot of fun. It's a bit unconventional in the way you put it together, and a little bit irreverent at times. You talk about isms, but you also talk about madness and artists in jail. Tell us about the concept for the book.
Well, I think the concept was originally that it was just going to be an A to Z of the art world. That's what Penguin wanted. But when I started writing it, I found more and more I was overtaken by wonderful memories of funny things that had happened to me in the pursuit of selling pictures to people. And it morphed into a sort of investigation, I suppose, of the relationship between art and money. And that sort of guilty embrace of the two. And as I say, I had a lot of fun writing it, and I was able to, I don't know what, sort of just put down quite a lot of things that had occurred to me as being comic or marvellous or piquant about the whole process of selling art to people.
And often you're showing art through the perspective of the dealer or the art house. I mean, you have 35 years of experience working in Sotheby's, but also Christie's, and also as a dealer, which is quite revealing. I mean, you have a section on the dealer and how the concept of the dealer has changed. But can you give us an insight into sort of how a dealer's perspective would differ from mine, for instance?
Well, I mean, I suppose one is constantly trying to make a sale, so one is concerned to present the work of art that one is selling in as positive a way as possible. And in that respect, although one uses the language of art history, it is very much using that language in order to make a sale. So there were certain things you try not to emphasize. If there is death in a picture, in the subject of a picture, it's generally not good commercial news. And I remember very early on cataloguing an old master picture of a larder still life, and I described it as with 2 sleeping rabbits, but it was palpable that they were dead and no one was fooled, and the picture failed to meet its reserve. So that was an early lesson.
And it's quite funny also that you sort of give some tips on whether or not the customer's going to buy, some sort of insights into the dithering prospective buyer and how to spot one.
Yes, I think every dealer and auctioneer would confirm that the thing they least want to hear from someone who seems to be on the verge of buying something from you is, "I must just talk to my wife about it." That's the classic get out. You know this is a deal that's going nowhere.
And tell us also, I mean, there's some wonderful chapters and some very beautiful, witty sort of summaries of artists, I have to say, but there's madness, there's artists in prison, but there's also muses, and there's fraud, which is something quite interesting to everyone, constantly fascinating, but especially from your perspective, I mean, with so many years in the business, give us an insight into how to spot a fraud and a little bit of an insight into that chapter.
Well, fraud is a fascinating subject, but there are degrees of fraud and there are degrees of authenticity. And sometimes, you know, it's not an out-and-out fake. It is a picture with an ambitious attribution, if you like. And I can illustrate this by telling you what happened to me once. I used to be an expert on the Antiques Roadshow for paintings, and it was noticeable on the Antiques Roadshow that the longer the programme went on, the more people came in with very high expectations rather than the reverse, and one was constantly having to let them down gently. And once I was on a show where there were so many people there that the police had to be called, and there was a policeman actually standing behind me at the table at which I was dispensing my expertise. And he was obviously an art buff because he was absolutely fascinated by everything I said and kept interposing his own comments, which was a bit embarrassing. And I was having a certain amount of difficulty explaining to the very nice lady who'd brought in a very nice-looking English landscape with a very, very ambitious and sadly fake signature attached to it. I was trying to let her down gently, and then I got help from a most unexpected source. The policeman strode forward and came out with the immortal words, "But I, on the other hand, madam, am a genuine constable."
I love it. That's a golden moment on the BBC Antiques Roadshow, if ever I've heard one. I mean, it's very interesting also to think about art and according to genre and this kind of sellability that you're talking about. One of your chapters is banality. You also have animals and sort of other sub genres, but I think banality is an interesting one. You seem a tiny bit ambivalent about the use of banality in contemporary art, for instance. But do you think that there are these certain things that sell, I mean, almost counterintuitively, become really part of the art world and the art market?
Yes, I would think that banality is a feature of modern art, and it's not just in art. I mean, one only has to look at literature and the way these things have developed in modernism, that engagement with the sort of nitty-gritty of life, the less attractive side of life, the more boring side of life, is somehow emblematic of being real. And therefore, banality is a feature of a lot of contemporary art. Another aspect of this is the difference between angst and anger. If you have an angry-looking sitter in, say, a 18th or 19th century portrait, it's not good news, because people want serenity, people want happiness, people want the sitters to look really happy about life. But round about 1900, suddenly angst, and it's no coincidence, it's a German word, comes into art, and you get the German expression that you get this premium on suffering, on internal discord, on man's existentialist problems with life. And so anger pre-1900, not good news. Angst post-1900 in a modernist context, very good news commercially.
Well, Philip, no wonder the book is so concise. There's the history of angst and melancholia. Thank you so much for joining me here in the Monocle Cafe.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
And back to you, Tom, in the studio.
Thank you so much, Sophie. That was Sophie Grove with Philip Hook. His book, if you need a reminding, is called Breakfast at Sotheby's, an A to Z of the art world. And who knew that angst all began at the turn of the 20th century? Up next on Aperitivo, we're going to visit the last country to produce one of the 20th century's most recognisable vehicles. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo right here on Monocle 24.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
and occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. It's exactly 18:45 here in London. Now, it might be one of the 20th century's most recognisable vehicles, the Volkswagen Transporter, or Combi, more affectionately known perhaps by most as the hippie van. It defined its era in the 1960s and 70s, and for most of us, it's a vehicle for our nostalgia, rather than from getting us from A to B. But in Brazil, the Transporters are still rolling off the production line. It's the only country that continues to produce this iconic vehicle. But sadly, not for much longer. New laws require all Brazilian-manufactured vehicles to be equipped with ABS brakes and airbags, amongst other safety features that the VW Transporter lacks. And altering the van's design accordingly just isn't seen as economically viable for Volkswagen, which has decided to cease production on the 1st of January. Monocle's correspondent Sheena Rossiter took a ride around Rio de Janeiro in a Combi to see exactly how sorely this special vehicle will be missed.
The rattle, hum, and sputter of a VW Kombi engine is a common and sometimes deafening sound on the streets of Brazil, with the vehicle being used for everything from transporting mail to selling hot dogs out of the sliding side door while parked on the side of the road. And it's been a popular vehicle since Volkswagen started producing it in Brazil back in 1957.
Olha, eu trabalho com transporte.
56-year-old Antonio Bernardo Madeiros inches his way around Rio in his old Kombi as he hauls a sofa, ceiling fans, and a chest of drawers, which are strapped into the rattling vehicle with only a few pieces of rope. This is his vehicle of choice for the small makeshift moving business he operates.
I've been working for a long time, even today with the Kombi. For me, it's been the best mode of transport for small services. I've had a Kombi for 12 years.
Antonio has driven his Kombi night and day for over a decade now, saying the only time it's parked is when it's out of gas. With his bursting beer belly, Coke bottle glasses, and his coy smile that's missing a few teeth, Antonio doesn't seem to match the same hippie image many Western cultures conjure up when they think about who can be found behind the wheel of a Kombi. Usually, the thought of a freewheeling hippie crisscrossing the United States on the way to Woodstock is what comes to mind. But in Brazil, according to Eduardo Rocha, editorial director of AutoPress, working class Brazilians like Antonio are the typical Kombi owners. He explains Kombis are typically used for work here, not play. Without a doubt, these vehicles are much more used for commercial use than for personal use, he tells me. Only in rare cases are they used for personal purposes. They make a really good, cheap commercial vehicle, he adds.
De primeira linha, é veículo comercial barato, realmente.
But the Kombi's ride will be rolling to a stop when production halts next year due to new regulation. Even though both airbags and ABS braking systems are required on all Brazilian sold cars as of 2014, the inability to stall airbags is what is stopping the Kombi from being produced, says Eduardo Rocha, who's been an automotive expert for the past two decades.
A Kombi é uma vítima da resolução 311, que diz respeito ao airbag.
He says that the Kombi is a victim of Law 311, which requires airbags and not the other law that requires ABS brakes, since those could be installed on any vehicle, even on a bike.
Você pode botar numa bicicleta. Nada impede de colocar o ABS. Então,
There's no room on the front panel, he says, to install airbags for the passenger. Volkswagen has said that it's not economically viable to redesign the engine. But for safety reasons, he adds, it's not a bad thing that the Kombi is forced into retirement.
Não é mal a Kombi sair. Não é mal em termos de segurança. É ruim em termos de mercado.
Aí manda importada de lá para cá.
The new law that would halt the manufacturing of the Kombi in Brazil because of the lack of safety features is worrying to people like Antonio, who think that the next step might be to take the vehicles off the road altogether.
I think the law is wrong because it's a mode of transport that serves the majority of the second class and the first class, people who need it in Brazil. I think it's wrong that the government is doing this. We need these Kombis. It functions just as much as a mode of transport, as a way to move things like a fridge, a washing machine, an oven. It works for everything. And it's not like a truck. It's reasonable for any type of service. There are more positives than negatives for Kombis. They do everything well.
With Kombis less likely to be on the road, he fears that it could impact his business and other businesses that are run by Brazil's expanding middle class.
Look, the majority of the middle class use Kombis to survive. And we're here to serve the population.
In a way, halting of the Kombis production in Brazil is just another sign of Brazil moving forward. Even though there are fears from middle-class entrepreneurs that their businesses will be hurt, there's no doubt that they will adapt to keep their businesses alive, even if it means relying on a mode of transport that has less character than a Kombi. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Ah, that distinctive engine sound did make me feel rather nostalgic, and I'd like to play some music in honour of the Volkswagen. This one's called Keep the Car Running. See what I've done there? It's by Arcade Fire. That's the sound of Keep the Car Running by Arcade Fire in honour of the Volkswagen Kombi van. Come on, Volkswagen. Keep making them. You know you want to. You're with Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. We're fast approaching the end of the programme. Sad news, I know. But before we go, let's have a look ahead at what's coming up on tonight's other excellent programmes here on the station. I'm joined by the producers of, respectively, The Globalist Asia and The Monocle Daily. It's Alad John and Annabel Bly. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Tom.
Oh, look at that. Beautiful. That was like a beautiful chorus. Alad, let's start with you. Globalist Asia, what have you got for me?
Okay. As you know, Globalist Asia, we, as the name suggests, focus on as many Asia stories as we can. So we're leading with the Thai opposition calling for mass protests against what is inevitably a very politically charged amnesty bill. Now, the bill, its supporters would say, give Thailand a fresh start after years of turmoil. That's around the time of the mass protests in 2010 that left over 50, I think, people dead. But the opponents fear that it's going to perpetuate a culture of impunity. It's effectively wiping the slate clean, namely for the former premier, Thaksin Shinawatra. Mm-hmm. His sister is now in charge. So as you can imagine, mass protests after something of a fairly fiery protest last few years, It may be not the most sensible thing to be calling for as opposition leaders, but perhaps inevitable. We're also going to be looking at sort of the journey some of the Syrian refugees they're making. Joseph Dana, we're doing a special two-part report. Tonight's looking at the journey that the Syrian diaspora have made from Syria to Egypt. next week, we're going to be looking at the similar journey, but of Syrian refugees heading to Turkey.
Intriguing stuff. I mean, we were actually talking earlier in the programme with Rachel Sherby and Kathleen Burke about the sort of overspill from Syria, yeah. The impact it's having this refugee crisis in particular. And it'll be interesting to get the take of Joseph Dana, our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, of course, charting these movements of people throughout that region. Intriguing, Alad. I'm intrigued.
I mean, there's much more stuff, but...
Don't give it all away early. Okay. You've got to tantalise, Alad. You've got to learn when to... You've got to learn when to let go. Let's cross the desk to Annabel Bly. The Monocle Daily. It's one of my favourite shows. Am I going to love today's instalment?
I think so. We've got a good mix of some hard political stories and some funner stories.
Why don't we... Let's zero in on one of these funner ones, Annabel. We haven't got that long left. Talk me through. Is it going to be a few chuckles?
Well, the reason I hesitated before saying fun was because we are going to be going on a bit of a hunt for a warlord.
That doesn't sound
like a million laughs, I've got to be honest.
But we'll be joined by a man who has gone into uncharted territory numerous times, so we'll be finding out what his plan is.
Wonderful stuff. Well, if that doesn't pique your interest, then frankly... you shouldn't be listening to Monocle 24. That's Annabel Bly bringing you the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours, and Alad John helming the good ship Globalist Asia. That's at 2000, not too long to wait for both those. My thanks to both for joining me in the studio. That's all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks in particular to my special guests, Kathleen Burke and Rachel Shabby. Today's show was expertly produced, as always, by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Alexa Firmnich and Andrea Alarcon, and our studio manager was Sean Malervi. Next up, after the headline, the entrepreneurs. We'll ask how American heritage brand Shinola is bringing manufacturing back to Detroit. So this show will be back at the same time tomorrow. Do join our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. He'll be here with Aperitivo at 1800 hours London time tomorrow. But for this edition of the programme, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. One year can inspire a lifetime.